Avat is to temple as to escape is to survive. Among the many stone Buddhas, a novice from Lang Prabang, barely half my naive years beneath those loose robes, was caught seconds before the next orange prayer, walking toward nirvana, his smile precocious. I wondered if someday, in a distant century, we would see a statue of him paving the way for my children. A discussion of monsters. In America, monsters arrive through Ellis Island, or from the stars, or morning's rogue angels. In Asia, the ghosts hop, hair long, eyes black, and girls from Taiwan will squeal in terror at that lonely world, but laugh with disdain at Hollywood soulless piles of pixels and latex signifying obsolete demons. An archaeology of snow forts. There's not much left to be said some well-washed stone hasn't heard before. History is composed of broken walls and bad neighbors. Just ask these chips from Berlin, the Parthenon and Cafe, or these cool magma hands of Pompeii, dark and gray. If you listen carefully in the right place on University Avenue, you will learn there is a minor wall near the Yalu River dancing on the hills of Qin for the moon. Who knows exactly what I mean in every tongue worth mention? She's moonlighting as a curved garden serpent, coiling around old Leokwan, the suspicious one with his astute eye, crooning with a sly wink, "Come, touch true history." And how the moon must laugh when she spies the tiniest hill in Minnetonka, where the small hands of the earth have erected a magnificent white wall, a snowy miniature Maginot, raised some scant hours before, already melting into a hungry, roiling river who is not yet finished eating Louisiana for brunch. Babylon Gallery. She brought the gray spoon we hung upon the Lake Street Gallery wall from the Talat stalls in downtown Ponsavan. She was supposed to be collecting Danen, folk tales, and we were showing off art we were so certain would change the way the world sees that stumbled elephant we rode in on. She was an indelicate work, this Buon, a light cockatrice feather, crude malice her center, her bowl an echo of bomb craters, whispering, mad as Gorgon. They dine with spoons like this all over there, we're informed. Hammered for more scraps the dogs find indigestible. They sold me this one, certain it's American bullets at the core. It was time, they said. We took them back. I pondered how many startled people these carnivorous spoons passed through in her previous incarnations, karma denying her a role in a finer flatware set for the saints. Oddly, for as many threads as she cut short, she was too weak to be the butter knife she should have been. "Swords into plowshares," someone scribbled casually on a comment card, one of many remarks, disposable as plastic sporks. Burning Eden, one branch at a time. My father, a skull before the wars were over, never saw my mother's flight in terror as our humbled kingdom fell to flame and shell. My mother was stripped to ink among the bureaucrats, a number for the raw statistic of jungle arrows collated into cold ledgers marked classified. Secret. My feet, dangling in the Mississippi, have forgotten what the mud invention feels like between your toes, while my hands hold foreign leaves and I whisper, "Maple, oak, weeping willow." As if saying their names aloud, will rebuild my home. Cameos. People would be surprised how often you truly show up in these poems of mine. Among various fantasies of lost civilizations and tongues, for words, for beauty and justice, for a wondrous era yet to come, on worlds vast light years from glittering Draco or Orion, where perhaps Lao outdid everyone by surprise after all, despite that shaky start since Jin Bin Fu in a galaxy far away, from an alternate timeline no one recalls. And you never recognize yourself in the tiny corner of these verses, or the moment we shared in a brief lifetime in that city we almost dared call home. Democracy IA. Father was a tiger, ground beneath the wheels. His fat was burned to light a torch, but there's no liberty here. Only the ashes of a village that couldn't evolve, where ghost grandchildren play with ghost grandparents, and the parents are nowhere to be seen at all. Where have they gone? Where have they gone? A delay of a day for an idea, a delay of a lifetime for the dead upon the ground. Look what remains. This hut hasn't the ambition of Ozymandias. These craters were once a rice field. This ox was no man's enemy. And what we have left to say could explode any minute. E pluribus unum. Yua tells me a story over the hot hibachi, how she went to Laos to see her lucky sisters for the first time in 2 decades, since the country has loosened up enough for tourists like us in. Isn't it beautiful, she asks me, then says she gave her sister Maylee $50 to help her family. When Yua returned to the Twin Cities, she learned her sister had been murdered for the money by Maylee's ex-husband, who'd heard of their family reunion and thought the cash rightfully belonged to him. Did you give your relatives anything, she asks. Yes, I reply, $500, but they say they need more to get to America. 5 fragments. Only 7 people walked away from Camp S-21. My critics asked me to find the beautiful words to make this more than a statement, chase the rhythms and meter to propel this into true poetry. Aesthetics mustn't die in literature. Don't starve language of your emaciated lyric. Don't keep back the flourishes that will set these words apart, or anger and memories will become only passing wind, and the tattered spines of your book about this camp will be thrown in the garbage without even the pomp of a Berlin book burning. Surely the 14,000 would appreciate that, who have no eyes, no voice, no hands to applaud and cheer anymore. They want me to splash in Pol Pot's rivers to find the true tears from mere fallen rain. But if you ask my neighbors across the hall, you'll find a particular indifference whether I succeed or not. Part 2. When the portraits came in black and white, stained and torn without a trace of artistic intent, they were mounted upon a plain white wall in the Weizmann Museum, across from a stout statue of a squatting Buddha and his irresponsible smile. Recovered from the mud after the Khmer Rouge went running, there were no names, only stenciled numbers that meant nothing the next day in the camp. How many years have they been touring these haunted faces, hoping someone would recognize them long enough to restore names to them? If the words, "It's tragic," cross your lips, the odds increase horrifically that you will give the matter no further thought within hours. In the upper gallery, Dion's solemn cabinet of curiosities, custom assembled for the university, was amusing the spectators with all the charm of a Renaissance scholar. All the usual divisions were there: underworld, sea, and air, the terrestrial realm, humankind, the library and archive, the allegory of vision, the allegory of sound and time, the allegory of history. Gaze upon a specimen of algae, a large hand-painted fan, a freeze-dried cow lung, a set of black Chinese binding shoes, birthing forceps from the late 1800s whose modern counterparts have barely changed, a Napoleonic teapot, in the words of Yul Brynner, etc., etc., etc. The day I went, a young woman in green muttered to her boyfriend, "What is this junk from the basement? It's not art, and it doesn't belong here." Moments later, he replied thoughtfully, "I wish they validated parking." Part 3. When the B-52s pummeled Nhạc Lôn by accident, over 100 Khmer died without cause for no more ceremony than a shrill whistle and a burst of flame and shrapnel from a mile high. Ambassador Schwenk came to assuage the grief of those who survived with a grand gesture of $100 bills, American, according to an anguished footnote from a man who had read about the matter in a London paper at the time. A woman I know from a village near Angkor Wat tries to escape the nightmares of the camps today by filling her house with tropical trees and flowers from her homeland she remembered as a little girl. In 1990, over an after-school match of Trivial Pursuit in Saline, my teacher asked, "What is the name of a country where Pol Pot instituted Year Zero, killing thousands of his countrymen?" "Cambodia," I answered with certainty, confident and familiar. "No," he replied. "No? Well, what the hell is it, then?" "The card says Kampuchea. It's the same thing." "No, it's not." 10 years later, I can't believe I argued over that point as I stare at crude wooden tables piled with skulls near Phnom Penh. Part 5. In 2 years, I don't believe I've said more than a dozen words to my Khmer neighbors in the apartment below me. That's just the way it is. The other day, I walked past the grandmother, trying to talk to her Hmong counterpart across the hall. Broken English, hesitant and uncertain, had become the bridge as each stood in their doorway, fumbling towards something resembling an ordinary conversation. Gardening and grandchildren seemed to be the subject. I still don't know what to make of it all, my head heavy as a mango without a mouth to feed. In the beginning, depending on the tradition you hear, there was nothing, or there was chaos. No time, no space, not even a single atom. Not a ray of light, a whisper, no scent of papayas or rivers. Not a body, not a soul, not a ghost of a Dok Champa, or even a memory of a touch in the darkness, or a taste of a home-cooked meal from a tiny garden in the window of a dreaming woman asleep amid her books and clothes, her brushes and tools. In the beginning, though, there was no hate, no war, no anger, no constant return to life after life because of our ignorance and lusts. Still, I look back with no regrets at our world of fires and love, of ice and hope. My mouth opens in song in the brief time upon earth I have, creating amid destruction, growing against silence. Hot sauce. Goes in hot, comes out hot. But this may be more than the casual student will want to know. Mom's grinding chilies for me in Modesto, red, green, a dash of fresh cilantro, fermented shrimp sauce and a pinch of salt between her mortar and pestle. Dabbing a sticky ball of cornel rice into the tiny ceramic saucer, I know. She's a sorceress in her kitchen, trying to find a way to say, she loves me, hoping my prodigal tongue is still loud enough to understand what her broken English cannot convey. My eyes are cisterns of tears after 30 years. I should say, Macbeth, and grab some cold milk, but with a smile through the pain, I stammer, Seplar me. Delicious, Mom. Seplar. Hak me. La la. Don't talk. Just eat, she says between her tears. Japanism, Laoism. Growing in the shadow of maples and pine cones when the actor was in the Oval Office, there were nearly no books about my realm of a million elephants. A tattered issue of National Geographic was my closest glimpse of a land I left 30 years ago as a waif, like all those impressionable French in Paris after Perry's thunderous stunt in the Yokohama docks. We were busy watching the toys and diodes pouring in from the Ginza. Shogun warriors and roaring atomic monsters smashing Tokyo's matchstick streets occupied our children, while Detroit and Zenith squirmed at their fallen market share, wailing about MacArthur and our post-war treaties. The word sub-ID was unheard of. It was better to learn to say sayonara while raising shrimpy shrubs sold as stylish bonsai. Back then, papayas were as rare as pad thai. It was sushi that was all the rage, as wasabi, horseradish, set your nostrils afire, gasping for water. I was trained to revere razor-sharp katanas in Zen, stoic as a bowl of udon. The heroes of my father, in the ruins of Lanchan and Luang Prabang, were barely footnotes, ground into mud in the aftermath of a wars no one wanted to remember. And now my skeletal editors call on me with their chattering skulls. Where are your words for Fanyum and Chao Anu, or the fallen honor that for Patusai? In all this time, surely one word about Venchan will not kill you or your friends? It's hard to answer, sitting down to eat in July. Write what you know, my teachers admonish. Sipping my soda, I turn the pages of a weathered book of Van Gogh prints inspired by Hokusai and the Ukiyo-e and sigh. My flag is as obsolete as the word Indochine. I realize today I am older than my father lived to be. It's been too long since I last saw an elephant or the monstrous river catfish. They tell me somberly the freshwater Irrawaddy dolphin will be extinct before the next time I come by. I couldn't sketch any of them with a dam if I tried. A part of me wants to smack the next person who says, I won't be Lao if I don't write about Laos. Do cops stop being cops when they're arguing about the White House and crooked pardons? Do robbers become priests if they talk about faith? Riviere saw the peaks of Hiroshima's Fujiyama among Eiffel's iron girders and still died, French and human. Just write, young man, I hear my father whisper. Just write, and we'll sort it all out later. And with the last bite, I return to making my own book with a defiant smile. Kopchai for nothing, Falans. The bomb popped in his face while he was digging a fire pit for his family, squatting on the old mercenary camp in Shenquan province, so notorious for its UXO. They live there for the American plumbing, our host said flatly, watching volleyball games by the airstrip. This was holy routine. The ruined grounds were frozen. Explosives, dormant blooms below, can be mistaken for ice and rock easily. And he screamed, the whole while as we loaded him into the back of our rickety plane, bound for Vientiane, that Lao Aviation picked up from the Russians when everyone thought the Cold War was going somewhere. The California girl on holiday was aghast and found it quite unscenic. What a pall on her search for highs. In Vatin Pen, a monk named Tsuk confided discreetly, we really hate hippies. Returning. Growing up in the Midwest in the 1980s, I ran into the idea of there and back again, of shires and armies and the mistakes of old men, to say nothing of monsters, of magic, and appreciation for roads and places undreamt by youth from Vientiane, the realm of a million elephants. Going on the road, or on travels with Charlie, seemed so far away, even as the poet's road became mine. The other day, I drove past acres of olives, almonds, and wine, to ports filled with coffee and fish, dancers from Nanchan. There was a stop in Missoula, a memory of vows and naturalization, a hot dog under big sky, hounds barking like Cerberus, keep going. In Sturgis, they love motorcycles and handguns. In Wall, there's jackalopes and plague-ridden prairie dogs. I wake up in the Midwest again, visiting Toofy Kaiju, a Rustin robot from the future. I cannot tell you anymore who was invading, who was defending. A singer I know found fame beneath a clown's grease paint, while I tell you of stars I know where I'll never set foot. Memory is a writhing hydra, yet I fear this poem most when it is Hercules with a sputtering torch. The Buddha of Bombies. There are more cluster bombs than people in Laos. They stopped falling in the year I was born. America left soon after. The other day, a young woman I know saw people turning war scrap into fashionable bracelets. No one considers turning them into statues of Buddha. Recycling only goes so far out here. A third of those who die every year are under 12, caught in the hot, swift center of flame and shrapnel, dormant for nearly four decades. Most of their parents weren't even born when those lethal leftovers were dropped. In America, my nieces sing, London bridges falling down. In Laos, my nieces sing songs not to touch the bombies. My new next-door neighbor is an old F-105 pilot my father picked up from the Hanoi Hilton. He knows my country well, but we don't have much to talk about, except our gardens. My cousin flew into Afghanistan at the start of a new war. We haven't spoken in years. I look at the pictures of hell in my mother's temple near Modesto. It's a new year, and young children run with toy guns sold to them by a vendor who could care less about karma and history. Our monks bless every living fin in sight, hoping it will do some good for a change. Ipsilanti, 1982. In 36 years, I barely spared a word about my days in Ipsilanti, known chiefly for giving us Iggy Pop and an obscure pioneer in continental drift. I was watching the 9 o'clock news with my father in our living room, as was the family habit. I was 9, eating a baby roof in June, when a picture of Vincent Chin flashed on screen with a discussion of murder, Japan, and the Motor City. My father said, not to take it personally, we were going to have a barbecue with our blue-collar neighbor on Saturday once he was done at the Ford factory. Our other neighbor across the way, with the tall, bottle-blonde daughters, was a Baptist preacher fond of discussing Pearl Harbor with me every other day, because I couldn't tell him a thing about Laos. Zelkova Tree. A friend warned me the other day not to write about the Zelkova, or I might come back as one and find myself cut into furniture just as things start to get interesting. The other day, the Zelkova Tree warned me not to worry about my friends, or I might stay human and find myself cut in furniture just as things start to get interesting. The Sticky Rice Blues. I've seen it 1,000 times in 12 years, read the rules, watched the videos, talked it over until someone's turned a different color. You never feel less Asian than days you burn the rice. But it's possible, even with a brand new bamboo steamer, a fistful of carnio, some heat and water. Some days, it's easier to be a cat in a temple, a morning fog, a frog splashing into a pond, a hungry ghost on a holiday, waiting for a bell from hell to ring.